Welcome. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. If you've never tuned into the show before, well, you've got a treat ahead, especially if you love books. This is an hour-long show where we bring you book reviews and author interviews. We've got everything from fiction to nonfiction and everything in between. We've got something for just about every age of reader. So get a pen and paper ready or open up your notes on your cell phone so you can take some notes and let's get on with the show. We're going to start off the show with something a little bit Italian. This is some fiction. It's by Hilary Prendini Toffoli. And Beryl Eichenberger is going to review her latest book, which is called The Homecoming. After that, Vanessa Levenstein chats to us about the new Marion Keys, which is getting lots of different reviews, everything from raves to the opposite of raves. After that, since this is Fine Music Radio, Philip Todras is bringing us information on three brand new opera books. In these reviews, Philip highlights how important Cape Town is to opera. After that, we bring you our young adult novel reviewer, Rachel van der Pfeiffer. She's chatting about a book called Not Like Other Girls by Meredith Adamo. And then we've got our thriller. Shirley Gula is here and she's chatting all things Harlan Coben. After that, we go into a really special book segment that's all about nature books. In fact, more specifically, more about bird books. John Hanks has got a bird book to talk about, and so does Jonathan Musikanth. And then we'll wrap up the show with an interview. Twangi Kalula is going to interview Beverly Rose Miller. Now, that name might sound familiar. Normally, she's on the show as a reviewer, but today she's on the show as an author. Beverly Rose Miller has written multiple books. Her latest is called Hunting the Seven, and it's about how the Guguletu Seven assassins were exposed. So this is fascinating true crime South African nonfiction, and that's coming up right at the end of the show. So let's get the show on the road, as they say. So since I've just been in Italy, I thought I would start the show with this very Italian book. Beryl Eichenberger is here to chat about Hilary Prendini Toffoli's latest. It's called Pistola, The Homecoming. This is a sequel, but I'm told it's also a standalone, so you don't need to have read the one to read the other. I think I have to pick this one up while I've still got the feel of Italy running through my veins. Hi, Beryl. What did you think of Hilary's latest novel?
Pistola, The Homecoming by Hilary Prendini Toffoli is like watching a big pot of authentic Italian ragu simmering on a slowly burning stove. Smelling the delectable aromas wafting across the room and sifting into every corner as your brain is filled with Italian deliciousness. Turning the heat up at times to thicken the sauce, turning it down to ensure no sticking, and finally allowing the ripe and lush taste to burst on your tongue. In short, the book is one to be savored. Every page a delightful journey, splashed with lashings of Italian words, cooking adventures, passion, and chatty narrative that takes you right into Pistola's world. Toffoli continues her story of the young Pistola from the tiny village of Campino in the Po Valley, who, as one of the 110 young Italian men recruited to work on the South African railways just after World War II, introduced Italian cuisine to the nation. Think of La Perla or Bella Napoli, and you've got the idea. It's a little-known story, and one that was well explored and embedded in Toffoli's first book, Love and Miracles of Pistola. A delightful dish of Italian and South African adventures, this sequel stands alone, as Toffoli weaves the previous story skillfully into the narrative. Pistola has now opened a small restaurant in Cape Town with the love of his life, Teresa. But it's the 1950s. They're not experienced restaurateurs, and the South African palate hasn't quite got there. So it's a bit of an uphill battle. For Pistola and Teresa, the Cape Town life is idyllic, except for the absurd apartheid laws, which they really can't get their heads around. Add to that, there's some boastful Italian colleagues who are opening a restaurant on the beachfront, so the competition is fierce. But things aren't going well at home in Campino. His nonno Mario, he of the magnificent Roman profile, tumbling locks, temper, and cooking skill, has hit a wall. Literally. The restaurant he's running in Pistola's inherited Villa Casa Caprini is suffering. The late owner's belligerent lawyer is about to visit to ensure that terms of the will are not being breached, and Pistola needs to get back to Campino fast to sort things and people out. Entertaining, salivating, oh mio Dio, a lesson in Italian cooking and the language, you'll be tossing those words around like a native, and a cast of characters that are as tasty and unpredictable as the storyline. Toffoli draws on her knowledge of the Italians, Italy, its food, and her extensive journalistic skills to create a unique, wildly extravagant, but wholly believable fresco in Pistola, The Homecoming. She entices us to the pages as we meet the larger-than-life Nonno Mario, who brought him up, his paramour, fake blonde Sandrina, with a mouth that sailors might envy, Zia Andromica, peacemaker, breadmaker, and all-round carer who can pour oil on troubled waters. The village is one big family, interfering, interested, and one that the reader immediately feels part of. A parade of cousins, Zios and Zias, emerge to hinder help and hope. Pithy and humorous, the essence of pathos makes for a satisfying read. Join the cast at this traditional Italian table. Raise a glass of Chianti, sip on a grappa, pour yourself a good espresso, and enjoy the adventures that bring the South African landscape together with the Italian lushness. Frogs, Fellini, frescoes and fossils melt into the pot. And let's not forget a Maledetto mushroom mission, film sets and a dark-skinned beauty who can upset an apple cart. The adventures are ebullient, effervescent and bubbling. They pour off the pages like a good wine, succulent slices of life. Oh, and did I mention the mouth-watering food? The book is available at Book Lounge, Clark's Bookshop, Takealot and Amazon. Pistola, The Homecoming by Hilary Prendini Toffoli is self-published.
Thank you.
That was Englishman in New York by Charles Duplessis and Zanta Hoffmeyer. See, we're very international. First a little bit of Italy and then a little bit of New York. And now we go to Ireland. Vanessa Levenstein is here to chat about My Favorite Mistake by Marion Keyes. So I've seen this book very widely reviewed, but in widely different ways. Some people have said they've absolutely loved it. Others who were previously Marion Keyes fans have said, after reading this, they'll never read another Marion Keyes book. Vastly differing reviews like this are fascinating to me because as a reader, you kind of have to wonder where you'll fall. Will you love it? Will you hate it? Which camp did you fall into, Vanessa Levenstein?
Marion Keyes books should come with a goodie bag, packed with lipstick, Botox vouchers, a life supply of HRTs, condoms, a bottle of wine for those who drink, Diet Coke, the chosen drink of one of her characters, Helen, plus a big box of tissues. Wait, in case you think this is too frothy, there's also serious stuff in the hamper. A book on the 12 steps, a number for the suicide prevention hotline, a list of accredited grief counselors, and then another goodie bag with pregnancy paraphernalia. With over 30 million books sold worldwide to many people, well, 30 million and counting, Marion Keyes needs no introduction. However, if you haven't read her, and particularly the books about the Welsh family, here's a cram course. The fabulously eccentric Mammy Welsh and her sidelined but adored hubby, her five daughters, who've all had their own struggles, demons, tragedies. They have fabulous clothes and get by with a little help from their friends and sisters. My Favorite Mistake is the second book about Anna. We got to know her and anybody out there when she survived a car crash that killed her husband. Fast forward 18 years later, and she packs up her life in New York to return to a tiny town in Ireland. She's there to help old friends set up a luxury coastal retreat. Yet there are obstacles all the way. The locals are threatened, and someone who doesn't want the resort built is playing dirty. Anna investigates, and as she digs deep into the heart of the matter, she also has to dig deep into her own beating heart, as an old flame, Joey Armstrong, appears. If you've read previous books, you'll do the Welsh geography. Joey is best friends with Luke Costello, who's the partner of Anna's sister Rachel. Will they or won't they? Is a theme that runs through the author's writing. Add to it some delicious scenes behind closed and not-so-closed doors, misunderstandings, and as we say, schnott and trana, there's a lot in the mix. I loved meeting up with the Welsh family again as they descend the small town en masse. We like classical music, Mum insisted, making us sound like peasants. We love the football song, the Italia 90 thing. How we celebrate and mourn female friendship weaves through My Favorite Mistake. Joey is not the only ghost from the past who transforms into a fleshy, present person, but also Anna's oldest and much-missed friend Jackie. Joey fathered Jackie's child, but always loved Anna. Yep, you could understand how that would shatter a friendship. But in true Marion Keyes style, there's always a second chance for love, be it romantic or friendship. I think this book is equal to her others. It just depends where you are in your life when you read it. If you've had a baby, read the first one, Watermelon. And if you're going through menopause, then My Favorite Mistake hits the HRT spot. Much like J.K. Rowling's Strike novels, another successful series from another very famous author, the book is on the long side and could have done with a trim, but that editor hasn't been born yet. Marion Keyes has endured a fair share of literary snobbery, and I'm not even going to go there, because my role is not to convince or convert you to read her books. But if, like me, you love reading a book that makes you laugh and then stop, and with a lump in your throat think, that's so me, then you're sure to enjoy My Favorite Mistake. The title alone gives you permission to embrace your own foibles and fabulousness.
Aha! So Vanessa loved it. I have a feeling I'm going to love it too. I've always been a huge Marion Keyes fan. She does something really special with humor and very deep, dark subjects. She can take something, she makes her books feel incredibly fluffy, but when you look beneath the covers, they're actually incredibly deep and insightful, and she covers such important issues, but she does it with huge flair and humor. So I have this one lined up, and I'm definitely going to read it. This is a very astute review, Vanessa. I loved what you said about how literary critics have always been very critical of Marion Keyes because she writes fluff. They've called it chick lit. And I think she really definitely has a space in the literary landscape, and she's earned a huge amount of respect. I am looking forward to this one. Next up, we dart in a vastly different direction. How about some books about fine music, since after all, this is Fine Music Radio. Philip Todras is here. He has 3 opera books that he wants to review, and they really highlight South African opera, but they also highlight the importance of Cape Town in the South African opera landscape. Could we be an international city of opera? I think we probably are already. Hi, Philip. Let's hear about these 3 important opera books.
The opera book launches, arranged by the South African College of Music and Opera UCT over the past few weeks, introduced one to the authors while providing a stunning showcase for the vocal talents of the academic team and the students at Opera UCT. That's proof positive that Cape Town has a very special place in the world of opera, past, present, and future. The first book is South African Envoys of Opera, Memories and Musing of Margaret Dacil Stemmet, who is the author, which is a superb overview of the contribution made by the South African singers internationally. As Jeremy Silver, director of Opera UCT, notes in his foreword, this is an encyclopedic book that charts the lives and careers of these dedicated singers who have captivated international audiences with their artistry and passion. And the passion best describes Margaret Dacil Stemmet's research, which is also based on the international career she had carved for herself. As intended, she has shied away from listing mere statistics and has tried to capture the personality behind each voice. In fact, she traveled thousands of kilometers trying to conduct personal interviews wherever possible. And there's a recipe accompanying each person covered in the book to add more of a personal touch. Margarita Stemmet, as she was known professionally in France, was interviewed by Rodney Trudgeon on People of Note, and this is available on a podcast on the FMR website. Definitely worth listening to give you an excellent insight into this major undertaking and the contribution made by the South African Envoys of Opera. The second book is by Hilda Roos, Ferrell John Davids, and Chris Walton. The book is titled Sorry, I Am What I Am, The Life and Letters of the South African Pianist and Opera Coach Gordon Jeffers, 1943-92. This book explores the life through the letters of the South African pianist and opera coach Gordon Jeffers, written to May Abramser, the well-known soprano in the Eon Group. Gordon Jeffers was a South African College of Music alumni who worked as an accompanist with the Eon Group before moving to Europe and establishing an international reputation. The story is told through a collection of letters that she has kept and provides a detailed account of his professional career and advice and information to his dear friend May. While this is a treasure chest of archival information, personally, I hope this will be a resource for an informed and balanced biography of Gordon Jeffers. On another personal note, I will never forget when May Abramser, the first lady of color, gave a recital at the Whites Only Nicola Malan Theatre Centre, now Artscape, with Gordon Jeffers as the piano. She received a standing ovation and as an encore sang, We Shall Overcome. It's a concert I personally will never forget. Then Opera in Cape Town, The Critic's Voice by Wayne Muller, is published by Sun Press. Phil Graham, an American publisher and co-owner of the Washington Post, famously said, Journalism is the first rough draft of history. To quote the author, art criticism shapes our thinking about art production, its aesthetics, and its place in society, while also charting the trajectory and the development and history of art in its guises and spaces. Tracing these narratives over time reveals the engagement of society with opera and unlocks a discourse on the future trajectory of what he believes is a distinctly South African operatic aesthetic. The narrative of this book has been shaped around 5 themes, each addressed in a separate chapter and related to particular operas that were performed in Cape Town during the post-apartheid era. In Chapter 1, the reigning aesthetics of Western European opera serve as a point of departure. That was what was. The transformation of the opera industry amidst the socio-political changes in South Africa that ensured the emergence of black opera singers and the introduction of new operatic works is the subject of Chapter 2. Chapter 3 focuses on strategies aimed at making opera relevant to a contemporary South African audience that have led to new operatic performances, and gives us an example of Adelio, which is particularly exciting. Chapter 4 argues that the adaptation of musical scores and libretti to Africanize opera has been instrumental in merging Western and African musical traditions as a political and cultural means of ensuring the relevance of opera. The final chapter addresses the composition and performance of indigenous South African operas and the construction of an operatic aesthetic distinct from Western European opera. So this covers a huge amount of territory. It's a book that you need to get involved in and get to know more about what's happening right now in the operatic field, and I think it's something that's going to definitely excite you. So three distinctive books focusing on opera, and we're very grateful to South African College of Music and Opera UCT for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you, Philip. So to sum up, the first book that Philip talked about is called South African Envoys of Opera by Margaret Dasel Stemmet. The second was Sorry, I Am What I Am, which is a biography of Gordon Jefters by Hilda Ruys, Feral John Davids, and Chris Walton. And the third book Philip told us about is called Opera in Cape Town, The Critic's Choice, and it's by Wayne Muller. Very insightful. Next up, I'm wondering, do you have children or grandchildren who like to read? Perhaps you have somebody who works for you who has children or grandchildren who like to read? Or maybe you have children or grandchildren in your life who you'd like to see read a little bit more. Well then, pull out a pen and piece of paper or tap this title into your phone. It's Girls Like No Other by Meredith Adamo. And our resident young adult fiction reviewer, Rachel van der Pfeffer, is here to review it for us right now. So, take a listen and see if this sounds like something you or the young adult in your life might be interested in. Sounds like a good read.
Not Like Other Girls by Meredith Adamo follows Jo as she attempts to unravel the mystery surrounding her ex-best friend and neighbor Maddie. Jo, once popular and well-liked at school, has become a social outcast after her former friends all turned on her. When Jo's former friend Maddie goes missing, everyone insists that she's just run away. But Jo isn't so certain. Convinced there's more going on than it appears, Jo decides to investigate the disappearance herself. She soon discovers that there's much darker things at play. Once I started reading, I was almost instantly hooked. The mystery element was really well written, and there was constantly new information and twists being revealed that kept me turning the next page. I also really liked that while the book revolved mainly around this mystery, it still took a lot of time to explore the characters' backstories and relationships, which made me a lot more invested in finding out how the story ended. Not Like Other Girls is written by Meredith Adamo and published by Bloomsbury.
Thank you, Rachel. Short and sweet and to the point, we like it. We really do enjoy your reviews. Next up, we welcome Shirley Gula. Shirley is going to review what she's called a thriller thriller. I like that. Me, myself, I'm a fan of a thriller thriller. And this one is by Harlan Coben. Even if you've never read a word of his, I'm sure you've seen all his stuff on Netflix and other streaming channels. Over to you, Shirley. Let's hear about this thriller thriller.
Super, super slick, super fast, super smart. It's Think Twice, and it's all about the fact that there is no such thing as a perfect murder. I'm afraid I only know Harlan Coben from his, well, super Netflix adaptations like Fool Me Once and Stay Close, and some of the other six that are on the streaming channel now with another six to come. Now it's time to get to the original word, because Harlan Coben is an original. To those who know him, knowing he has already written 33 novels won't come as a surprise, and that, despite many of the Netflix adaptations being British, he is American. I prefer psychological thrillers, but discovering a straightforward series of thriller thrillers is sort of thrilling. Basketball superhero come attorney Myron Bolitar, a character who has his own series which is scheduled for its own Netflix premiere, is a sportsman who was forced to retire when injured, and he developed a reputation for ensuring justice is served. When friends come into play, well, that's more of a catch, right? It's a good story, credible, fast-moving, and intelligent. A dead man who may not be dead and may be responsible for a killing or two. A son who is not a son but may be linked to more than the obvious. A facade as a military intelligence man, well, is that true or not? A few ex-wives, not necessarily Myron's. Lies, deception, love. A number of coincidences and conflict. The dark side of detection with the FBI getting involved with handlers named P.T. You think you know who done it, But you're wrong. Then there's the underworld with Joey the Toe, for good measure. Rich people with Upper East Side apartments with views of Central Park and the Metropolitan Museum on the one side, with John Lennon's memorial and fabled Dakota apartments on the other side. Private jets, private gyms, references to the Vermeers in the Frick, and the Chagall in Myron's mate's own apartment, all point to Coben's research of lifestyle, or his own lifestyle, and they are certainly redolent of the good things in life. Who knows? Coben might have the means to own his own Chagall. Coben's dialogue is so good, it makes you believe that people can actually talk like that. People have the slick discussions you can only dream of, the sort of argument you had with a partner or colleague or rival. The right answers, the smart answers, just come. I do know now that I am hooked and will seek Myron and Harlan out for some good winter reading. That's when I'm not watching Harlan on Netflix.
Was Take Five by Debbie. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we've got a bumper nature book segment today. We have not one bird book, but two bird books. Somebody tweet about this immediately. And both our reviewers are named John. Okay, now you have to tweet about this twice. The first book is going to be reviewed by John Hanks. It's called Newman's Birds by Colour. I'd never heard of this title before, and I thought it's such a clever idea to show birds by their colour. But then I saw that it's the fourth edition. So, okay, this isn't this book's first rodeo. It's clearly so successful that, in fact, it's in its fourth iteration. This is Newman's Birds by Colour, reviewed by John Hanks.
The fourth edition of Newman's Birds by Colour has just been published, and I have no hesitation in giving this edition my strongest possible recommendations as an essential guide for helping beginner birders with simple, practical tips for identifying the birds they have seen, focusing initially on a bird's most striking feature, namely its colour. As Kenneth Newman has highlighted in the introduction, and I quote, "There's little doubt that the features memorised by most novice birders are the bird's approximate size and its colour, or the colour that made an impression." This latest edition of Birds by Colour focuses again on the first impressions of colour for the design and structure of the book, with 15 categories used, but all considerably updated by Nicholas Newman from the earlier editions, with revised artwork, the latest common names, expanded habitat information, and up-to-date distribution maps. Four or five birds are described on each page, with their English common names at the top and arranged under each colour section, with the smaller birds at the front and the larger ones at the end. The distribution maps help to confirm that the bird you saw actually does indeed occur in the region you're in. The text for each species includes a concise summary of each species' habits and key identification features, with common names also in local languages. The distribution maps now have a most useful two initials in the bottom right-hand corner of each map, showing the threat status for the species, namely EN for endangered, CR for critically endangered, NT for near threatened, and VU for vulnerable, which would help all those committed to the conservation of biodiversity guide them on priorities for action. Encapsulated by Nicholas Newman in the preface, and I quote, "It is also helped that this guide will encourage interest in the conservation plight of birds and will inspire readers to care for the environment and the world in which we live." There's no doubt that all new birders, and also those more experienced field enthusiasts too, should be encouraged to always carry a notebook, and not only to record first colour impressions, but also any other colour features of note and important additional items, such as beak, shape, size, and habitat. Some species are in more than one of the 15 colour categories used, such as the Bok Mekeri, which is described in the first impression colour category of grey plumage, then in yellow plumage, and lastly in the section on collars and breastbands. And this is where additional notes made in the field of the sighting can help to firm up the identification. There's also a most useful section in the guide entitled Newman's 5-Point Check, which calls attention to the importance of recording the following five key points when sighting an unfamiliar bird, namely colour and markings, size, habitat, behaviour and activity, and distribution, with most helpful notes on what to try to record for each of the 5 points. This fourth edition of Newman's Birds by Colour, updated by Nicholas Newman and just published by Strake Nature, an imprint of Penguin Random House South Africa, is selling at R450, and this comprehensive guide is excellent value.
And now let the birding goodness carry on. We've got Jonathan Musikanth, who's here to chat about a birding field guide. It's called Birds of Greater Southern Africa, and it's by John Fanshawe, Keith Barnes, and Terry Stevenson.
It's been my great pleasure to spend some time with a new birding field guide, Birds of Greater Southern Africa, by Keith Barnes, Terry Stevens, and John Fanshawe. Birders will be familiar with the current stable of birding field guides that have been around for years, and in some cases, decades. So it's exciting when something new comes along. When it comes to birding, you can never have too many field guides in your library. Each field guide will have unique bird images and some new information. So, should you add Birds of Greater Southern Africa to your birding library? Let's get into that. First, the positives. The clue to what makes this field guide unique is in the title. This is not just a birding field guide for Southern Africa. It's a birding field guide to Greater Southern Africa. Whilst current field guides cover the area limited to South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Eswatini, Lesotho, southern and central Mozambique, this field guide includes the further countries of Malawi, Zambia, and the areas of northern Mozambique and the larger than typical marine environment up to and including the edge of Antarctica. The result is a list of 1,172 birds covered, rather than the more typical number of around 970. The field guide is well laid out and easy to use. The bird descriptions, in many cases, are more detailed and longer than is found in other field guides. We have come to expect a very high standard from the bird images in field guides, and this field guide does not disappoint. I would say that the artwork in this field guide is at least as good, if not better, than any other general bird guide for our region. I notice the paper seems to be not quite as glossy as some of the other field guides, which results in a beautiful tone to the bird images. For me, the artwork is reason enough to have this field guide. It seems horrendously unkind to have to deal with any negative aspects to such a beautiful book, but for the sake of completeness, here goes. This field guide covers a larger geographical area and is more detailed than most similar field guides, and that means that the field guide is bulkier and heavier than other options. I'm unlikely to carry this field guide out with me into the field when other lighter options are available. I would, however, happily refer to it after a day out in the field. I think someone new to birding would benefit from a field guide that is more limited to the local area they are likely to visit. When first coming to grips with bird identification, one is likely to start in South Africa, and it may be daunting to be confronted with images of birds of northern Mozambique. This will, however, not present any problem for the more experienced birder. I was surprised to see that the bird descriptions do not include the weight of the bird, rather just the bird length. Knowing the bird's weight gives you an idea how bulky the bird is in appearance. The detail on the bird distribution maps are a bit small, owing to the larger geographical area displayed in a usual size block in the field guide. So, who would I recommend the birds of Greater Southern Africa to? Anyone who's been birding for a while? Someone who already has one or two bird field guides? A more adventurous birder who will be exploring the lesser visited areas of Southern Africa? Someone who appreciates the art of bird illustration? I'm certainly delighted to expand my birding library with this unique bird guide. Happy birding!
That was Love the Softest Heart here on Fine Music Radio. You're listening to Book Choice with me, your host, Paige Nick, And this whole show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. Right, we're heading up now into one of our last segments. Twangie Kalula is joining us to interview Beverly Ruiz Miller. As I mentioned before, Beverly Ruiz Miller is no stranger to this show. Every 2 weeks, she's here with wonderful, insightful book reviews. Today, she's here talking about something slightly different. Today, instead of a book review, she's the author that we're reviewing. So we're turning the tables. Twangie Kalula chatted in the studio to Bev about her latest book, which is called Hunting the Seven, How the Guguletu Seven Assassins Were Exposed. This is true crime nonfiction, right here on Fine Music Radio, on Book Choice, with me, your host, Paige Nick. Hi, Twangie. Hi, Beverly. Congratulations on the launch of yet another book. Bev, you're a machine. Let's hear about this one.
In 1986, during a state of emergency at the height of apartheid, seven young men in Guguletu were assassinated by the police in broad daylight. The official story was that they were terrorists who were neutralized while plotting to ambush a police vehicle. But for the astute journalists on the scene, there was way more to the story. In her haunting new book, Hunting the Seven, our very own Beverly Ruiz Miller puts all the pieces together. It is so strange talking to our own book review darling on the other end of the mic. But I basically just wanted you to start by explaining the story very briefly and how you were connected to it personally.
Okay, so I think the whole of country was shocked when the story came out. And the police version was that early in the morning of the 3rd of March 1986, seven young men tried to ambush a police van going into Guguletu, and the brave policemen who were lurking in the bushes waiting for them to do this, and one wonders why they didn't stop them before the ambush, but that comes out in the book. They were all killed within a matter of 8 minutes over quite a large area of ground. From the beginning, the story sounded really dodgy. And luckily, it went out in the news media as this fantastically brave, you know, security policeman who'd saved the country. But there was one Cape Times journalist called Chris Bateman, quite new in Cape Town, who was also fluent Zulu speaker. And he started speaking to witnesses he found in the nearby hostel. And the story that came out was a totally different one, that these guys had been trying to actually surrender when they had been simply executed.
I was haunted by the story I read it over 3 days, and each night I kind of dreamt about different aspects of it. And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, this event happened almost 40 years ago. The truth came out, let's say, just over 20 years ago. But it seems to have still haunted you for many years. Was that one of the reasons you decided to write this book now?
Oh, definitely. You know, I had just last year written Bullet in the Heart, which was about the Boer War. And that was, you know, that information was about the Boer story of the war. And that information was beginning to disappear. And the problem is that if we don't capture information, there's an old saying, what isn't written down never happened. And I started feeling that this was such a puzzling story. Nobody had actually ever really properly understood what happened that day. Even I didn't until I reached right at the end of the book. And we're not going to say what happened, but you will know what happened.
And it's worth reading. It's worth getting to the end of the book.
Thank you. But I think that my personal connection to the story started very early when I met the bereaved families. There were seven mothers who had, you know, their sons never came home. And then they saw them dead on television. They were never told by the police. It was just this brutal thing that had happened. And those mothers hunted for the truth for years and years, and they never got any closure. I had met them soon after it happened, and then a wonderful member of parliament from Greenpoint, Tiaan van der Merwe, and I were part of helping to organize the funerals. There were actually two funerals, as you will remember,
yes,
because one of the bodies was so mutilated that they actually buried the wrong guy in the first funeral. And having met them and having seen what they'd gone through, and they were brutalized. Some of them were tortured by the police after this had happened. It kind of really haunted me and stayed with me. And I just kept thinking one day somebody should write this story and try and find out what really happened. And, you know, the day came. And I thought, well, if not now, when? So there we were.
I wanted to delve into the kind of writing process, because if you look back at it, obviously you were there at the time and there were things that you remembered. But when you went back after all this time and started chatting through people and digging through people's personal archives, it must have opened up a lot of new questions and kind of picked at a lot of old wounds as well.
First of all, the the people who are in the book were incredibly supportive, and they recognized what I was trying to do. And it was horrible. It was a terrible book to write. And also, I had to read thousands of pages of really gruesome evidence, look at the post-mortem photographs, which were terrible. And so it was a horrible book to write. But I also thought it was an important one, because it never was quite clear why they had done it. And the connection to Flugplatz at that stage was not known until the TRC. And then I had to ask the question, why was this the only time that Flugplatz ever came to the Cape? What was their reason for doing that? And nobody had ever asked that question. It's one of those things where if you don't ask the question, you'll never find the answer. And that was what I was trying to do throughout the book.
One of the things that I found quite fascinating was that the kind of impact is still felt in the community, even though perhaps younger people in the community have forgotten what's happened. Why did you think it was so important to kind of remind people that seven innocent young men who had families and hopes and dreams were kind of gunned down, you know, that night for what was actually a vanity project, in a sense?
Yes, and by the way, a financial project, because Flugplatz, and I lay this out, really funded the politicians and the generals. So don't think that corruption started after 1994. I really do lay that out. But I thought it was important because only three people ever applied for amnesty. They were all from Flugplatz, and even though they admitted that they had lied, they all got amnesty. But there were a lot of Cape cops present in this huge killing scene who walked away. And to this day, those inquests still stand. The police were innocent. And so my feeling is that the justice has not yet been done.
Well, I have to just say thank you very much to you for contributing to kind of this historical canon. There are still so many questions I have. And you're one of those terrible authors who have shared all the references. So I've got a long reading list now because of it. But my big takeaway was that we often complain that we aren't documenting our stories. And it's often difficult to go into the past to a story that was very close to your heart, especially. But you have made this contribution and it is skillfully told. I was deeply moved by it and I'm still haunted by it. And I just want to say it's a job well done. I strongly, strongly recommend that if you live in Cape Town or anywhere in South Africa for that matter, that it's important to read this book and remind ourselves how far we've come, particularly at this political turning point. So thank you so much for joining us, Bev.
Oh, thank you
and
so much.
All the best with the book. Hunting the Seven by Beverly Rose Miller was published by Jonathan Ball and retails for 330 Rand.
Hugs the shore, hold me close, sway me more. Like a flower bending in the breeze, bend with me, sway with me. When you dance, you have your way with me. Stay with me, sway with me. Other dancers may be on the floor, dear, but my eyes will see only. I can hear the sound of violins long before it begins. Make me thrill as only you know how. Swing smooth, swing
by. That was Sway by the Glenn Robertson Jazz Band. Welcome back. You're still tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. If you're a regular listener to the show, you will know that if you've missed any of the reviews or titles of books on any part of today's show, Mzu will load a podcast of the show onto fmr.co.za, or you can find the podcast of the show on the FMR app, so you can listen back and find any info you may have missed. You can also share the show with a friend if you think you know somebody who might enjoy it. Right, so at this point at the end of the show, I often tell you what I've been reading. But today I want to talk about something a little bit different. I want to tell you about a literary publication that might interest you. It's called New Contrast, and it's South Africa's oldest literary magazine, so it's been around the block. If you haven't heard of it before, New Contrast was started in 1960 by Jack Cope. In its illustrious history, it's published literary giants like Nadine Gordimer, Ingrid Jonker, and J.M. Coetzee, So with a backlist like that, you can only salivate for whatever they have coming up next. And you'll be pleased to hear that it doesn't disappoint. The new issue of New Contrast magazine has just been launched. This is issue number 205. I think they've had a hard time of it over the last couple of years, but then who hasn't? But it feels like this is a whole new era for the magazine. It's almost a relaunch of sorts. They've appointed a new team with Sindisiwe Busuku as the new editor. Sindisiwe is a UCT lecturer and the Ingrid Jonker Prize winner for her first collection, impressively. This bumper 125-page issue of New Contrast was created by an all-woman team. You can read prize-winning poetry, extracts from The Nine Lives of the General by Yawande Omotoso, and this is a sidebar from me. Yawande Omotoso is one of my favorite South African authors. She is extremely talented, and to hear that she has a new book coming out, The Nine Lives of the General, or a work in progress, is very, very exciting for the South African literary community. They also have an excerpt from Corin Jennings' upcoming novel called Crooked Seeds, Unwrapping by Frankie Murray. Now, Frankie Murray is one of the curators of the Open Book Festival in Cape Town, so she's also quite a big name in the literary world. And there's also The Best a Man Can Get by Hedley Twiddle. So these are some incredible contributors to New Contrast magazine. Something else they have in New Contrast coming up is Robin Patterson interviews their featured artist, Amy Lee Braff, who's a South African artist born and raised in Joburg, working as a painter, illustrator, and photographer for the last 8 years. She goes by Hako Pike. I hope I'm saying that right. I've only ever read it. There must be a term for that, when you've only ever read a word and you've never heard it, so you don't know how to pronounce it. Hako Pike? Hako Pike? I'm not sure. Anyway, they have this interview with Amy Lee Braff, who's the South African artist. There are also poetry and book reviews and so much more. You can find New Contrasts at the Book Lounge or at Clark's Books in Cape Town or Love Books in Johannesburg, also at Exclusive Books. Speaking of Exclusive Books, that brings us to the end of this wonderful show, which has been sponsored by Exclusive Books. My thanks goes to all our reviewers, authors, and the publishers who share their books and their knowledge with us. Also, a big thanks to Mzu Makete, who pulls this show together for us every week and curates all the music we've been playing. Like this next track, which we're going to be playing out with, which is The Child in You by Tina Scar. Until next time, happy reading!
I remember when I was a child, after spending the day running wild, I'd retire to my aunt's room. I'd wear her jewelry and I'd smell her perfume. And I'd say, I want to be grown up and big like you. I want to do the things that grown-ups do. I want to wear lipstick and tease my hair. I paint my toenails red and make people stare. She'd say, slow it down, hear what I say. Your time will come to be a woman someday. Just treat yourself with more love and more care. Love the child you are inside. That's a dare. That's a dare. Now I'm big, I do the things that grown-ups do. I don't get chicken pox, I just get the flu. I spend my time running around all day. There's time for work, but there's no time for play. I am exhausted, Tina Stress is my name. But being an artist, it comes with a game. Dear Dr. Groom would say I'll take some time out. He obviously doesn't know what my life's about. He says, slow down, hear what I say. You got to find time, there must be a way. Treat yourself with more love and more care. Love the child you are inside. That's a dare. That's a dare. Old William Shakespeare once put it this way. To thine own self be true as night follows day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. Take heed of the picture, take heed of the plan. Look to yourself, in that there lies the key. Everything you are is what life can be. Love lives inside you, it's your shining sun. Open its doors and this love will reach everyone. Will reach everyone. This thing called life moves by so fast. before you know it, it's gone in a blast. And just the other day, I nearly died when a drunken driver crashed into my side. Well, that got my attention. I was quite wired at the thought that I had nearly been retired. I made a promise to myself I'll be nice, and I will heed the good doctor's advice. Slow it down, hear what I say. You got to find time, there must be a way to treat yourself with more love and more care. Love the child you are inside. That's a dare. That's a dare. Look into yourself and that's the key. Look into yourself and that's the key. Look into yourself and that's the key.